tunnels are underground, where none of the children will ever be found. They wandered away to join the show and lost their way in the world below. They joined the circus and left their town. Now they live here down with the clown.
Beware, spoiler phobes! You have stumbled into A Storm of Spoilers, a podcast covering the adaptation of Stephen King's It that is Welcome to Derry on HBO. This podcast is split into two sections. The first section we call The Calm. We will only cover a single piece of It media. This week, the fifth episode of Welcome to Derry on HBO titled Kneebolt Street, and will not spoil anything we know about future episodes of Welcome to Derry, though this week we have to speculate about an old woman we met in the movie It Chapter 2. In the second Storm section, Neil and I will break down what to expect from It Welcome to Derry based on the teaser for next week's episode, some foreknowledge of what the production has hinted is ahead, and descriptions of the final episodes. We're not spoiling, we're enriching. Why, hello, I'm Dave Gonzalez, and I've read the book by Stephen King.
And I'm Neil Miller, and I have not read the book by Stephen King, but I am feeling pretty happy this week because I picked that weird clown song for our intro. And welcome back to A Storm of Spoilers, and welcome back, Pennywise. But before we get to all of that, some upcoming schedule and housekeeping nonsense. Of course, next week we will be back for Welcome to Derry Episode 6, titled In the Name of the Father. More on that and what it means in the storm. And our Derry era will continue to take us into December. And then, as we've announced many times at this point, next year in January, we expect that HBO will be dropping A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms, which we will be covering. I've loaded up my audiobook, and I will be rereading that.
Oh, good.
In anticipation of diving back into Westeros. Very exciting.
Also
stuff.
Renewed for a second season already. So an investment worth making.
Good for them. If you would like to see this podcast with your eyeballs instead of just your earballs, you can watch us on YouTube. You can get full episodes, youtube.com/@DaveAndNeil, DA70ANDNEIL, where you can see our smiling faces or horrified looks and all of the hilarious thumbnails that Dave has been making for our YouTube videos. And listen, whether you watch them or not, we greatly appreciate you going to our YouTube page. Hit it with a subscribe, hit the videos with a like, maybe even leave a comment. Do whatever you need to do to help us defeat the YouTube algorithm. And we greatly appreciate it. If you'd like more from Dave and I that is not clown related, you can join us over at patreon.com/DaveAndNeil, spelled the same way. Get bonus content from all of our Storm of Spoilers stuff and all the way back to the Game of Thrones, original Game of Thrones era. And all kinds of new content that we put out every week, including our weekly adventure podcast. This past week, we dove into the Fantastic Mr. Fox as part of our 90 Minutes of Fun series. Next week's mailbag week, so that'll be pretty fun. And if you join us at the highest tier of our Patreon, you'll be getting podcasts every week for our Hannibal rewatch podcast called Eat the Rood. We are in quite an interesting part of Hannibal as we hit the last few episodes of season 2. It is getting wild. You will also get access to a couple of previous rewatch projects that we did, including my first time through Twin Peaks and both of our first time through The Leftovers, both of which are really entertaining. So join us on Patreon. That's a really great way to support not only the work we do over there, but help us keep this podcast going as well. All right. Speaking of this podcast, here's how you can get in touch with us. You can always send us a raven, stormofspoilers@gmail.com. We did get one listener email this week, Dave, that I'm going to mention up here because it's not necessarily related to Welcome to Derry, other than it is about a little bit of confusion that one of our listeners had. We received an email from listener Jeremy about how they weren't aware of what Welcome to Derry even was before listening to the pod and thought that maybe it was a Derry Girls spinoff. And boy, were they surprised because this has nothing to do with Derry Girls, even though that's a great show and you should watch it. So
my YouTube algorithm also thinks that I've suddenly become interested in Dairy Girls behind the scenes content, which is, you know, very pleasant. It's a very comforting watch.
It's actually a really good palate cleanser after you're done watching Welcome to Dairy related content. You can also, in addition to sending us emails, review us on Apple Podcasts or send us comments on Spotify. The rule, of course, leave us a 5-star rating and say whatever you want. We did get a new review on Apple Podcasts from a listener named Jackie, who says, "I love this show for a lot of reasons, but I especially enjoy Polygon Corner and other peaks behind the filmmaking curtain. I wouldn't have watched Alien Earth or Welcome to Dairy on my own, but I watched both so I could follow along with the podcast and am really enjoying them so far. So thanks, y'all." Jackie, you are very welcome. And we're very happy that you're not only joining us, but enjoying the shows that we're choosing. We try to choose well. So there you have it. Speaking of shows that we've chosen, it's time to enter the column and talk about episode 5 of Welcome to Dairy, Kneebolt Street.
Kneebolt Street. I am very interested in what this show has become, Neil, because there's a bunch of stuff this week that I thought was amazing the second it came on screen. And
I imagine you were pretty happy because there's a lot of stuff in this week's episode where I was like, "Oh, Dave called that. Ooh, Dave called that too."
Hey, I'm feeling good about myself. I'm surprised how much of Dr. Sleep is in this episode of Welcome to Dairy, which I know you've seen the screen version of. So you have a vague idea what was happening with the boxes. Sure. But
I've also seen the extended director's cut screen version. So.
Yeah, indeed. I was very, I had to go back and watch some of those parts and was very interested to see that, Dr. Sleep is on Netflix, and you have to do a little digging, but I think the director's cut is also an option on there, so make sure not to just click on the poster version. Anyway, we are back to doing some corners after we cover some big thoughts, but I do have some sort of larger thoughts that I want to get your opinion on before we delve into maybe plot breakdowns. One is, this episode, I think, leaned a lot more into color theory than other episodes, or maybe I hadn't been looking at it as a strong theme of the series up until now. But it does look, at least for now, it is copying sort of what the movie brought to Pennywise, which is red is sort of the color that represents Pennywise. The red balloons, obviously, here, the father that attacks Hank when he's being transferred is wearing sort of like the red jacket. We get this idea that red things or things in red are maybe a little bit more tainted by Pennywise. What that says, that Miss Kirsch has a red skirt, we'll have to talk about when we get into talking about her character. Mm-hmm. But I am a little curious about what came across to you as a viewer as what yellow means, because we also have Charlotte in like a yellow dress in that very same scene where Hank is, you know, going to get shot at. We have the extreme sort of yellow lighting as the kids are under three Mommy's Little Helpers each while underneath the ground. So what are you getting as a read off of yellow? Is this a good thing? Is this a bad thing? I've seen them sort of interpreted both, but a lot of them are sort of hinging on the fact that Maddie comes out of a yellow tent. Is this to make them feel better that this is Maddie? Or is this, as we figure out at the end of the episode, a hint that whatever comes out of that tent is closer to red, like the color yellow?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's the red, it feels very unsubtle as far as like proximity to Pennywise, especially once the soldiers get down in the sewers and turn on all their red lights. It's like, oh, here it comes. But yeah, the yellow feels like it is, it's almost like a stoplight at a, at an intersection, right? Red is obviously stop, danger, don't go through the intersection. Yellow means slow down because you're about to have to stop. So yellow, I think in this instance might mean slow down because you're about to encounter clown. And I think that that's a pretty safe. Now, that metaphor could take on a new meaning if we start to see a lot of green somewhere, but given the nature of Dairy and how deeply embedded the evil entity is in this town, as we learned in this episode, I don't think we're going to see a lot of green if that's the case.
Right.
I think we are all kind of in yellow territory at best. And many people have entered a red territory. So I do like this, though, because, you know, I think that this show, one of the nice things about this show is that it has a lot more time and room to sort of ruminate and let this town sort of simmer a little bit and deliver some of the more meticulous detail and nuance that I think that you would get from a very long book. Maybe not right. All of what you would get from a very long book, but you know, similar to the fact that we've kind of been talking about how Andy Muschietti really leaned on the clown iconography in the movies, both out of a sense of how good Bill Skarsgård was, but also seemingly because that's all he kind of seemed like he had time for. This show seems to not be rushing toward that. And I think that this episode's a really good example of where that patience is paying off.
Right.
And so I think, you know, things like being able to do a little bit more intentional color theory in your production design is a benefit of being of doing a, you know, season of television instead of a single 2-hour movie.
I think I had up until now the sort of like on the fence about how much care production was taking with some of these things. Mm-hmm. We have based some of our theories in the storm section off of things like, you know, Phil and Maddie's faces not rotting on the boxes in the, mm-hmm. you know, the sequence in the supermarket earlier. And now to see that sort of used against us with the kids here,
yeah,
means that I'm now looking a lot closer at what the show is, even in relegating to background details, because a lot of those background details seem to be very important. And they're very important to the degree where if it were, you know, what I would call, no offense to any real person, like a stupid show, where they were really spoon feeding me these pieces and I was super ahead of it, then I would think about it one way. Falling into the is Phil alive, basically trap that they wanted me to over these past couple of weeks gives me a new respect narratively for the show for attempting some things.
Yeah.
And I think this episode, it needs that credit because I do think this episode moves really fast in the Leroy Hanlon dilemma, mm-hmm. where he almost shoots his kid, but then shoots his best friend.
I do want to say one more color theory thing before we move on. When a character shows up that we haven't seen for a while and they are gray in skin tone,
yeah,
that will never not be suspicious to me. And I was a little weary of Maddie.
That's good.
From the jump.
And see, I thought it was dumber. So Java, my partner, even asked me, why is he so pale? And I was like, he's been in the sewers for weeks.
Yeah.
But I fell into the lore trap.
Yeah. But so, I will say this, even though initially when he comes out of that yellow tent and he's very gray, I'm like, what the hell? There's no way there's something wrong here.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that they do with having the kids in the sewer and then having the soldiers repeat several times, if you see something that's not supposed to be down here, just shoot it. Knowing that eventually somebody's going to take a shot at one of these kids distracted me from that. So that by the time we do get to the big reveal of Maddie and Pennywise, it kind of did surprise me a little bit. I mean,
okay, good.
So I think it was just in the context of this episode, they did a really good job of like weaving around to kind of throw me off the scent of what was going on with Maddie.
Because I think this episode does a lot. It is super lore heavy if you look at it from one direction, but also I think includes some character like almost flips, but they're just sort of like hidden in the side of the plot. So let's talk first about our corners. The only 1960s, like most 1960s thing I found is General Shaw is watching that news coverage of the race riots before Rose comes in, which also comes after the scene of Charlotte on the phone with somebody talking about getting Hank out. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, this is implying that maybe the movement could come to Derry. But this is also before Charlotte knows that she's trapped in Derry with a fear monster that's feeding on her children.
Sure. Well, and I do think that it feels like the show, especially in this episode, is pushing this narrative further to the point where they're going to need some help when it comes to Hank. And I think that now that Hank is on the lam, it's only going to, the racist sentiment in the town may only fester further, especially as the Pennywise energy of it all amps up toward what we're told could be a big him going out with a bang here in this cycle. So I think that it's good that the show keeps reminding us that Charlotte is connected to the movement and that this may come to pass, especially if, say, some of the white residents of Derry go and try and kill a bunch of the black residents of Derry for some weird reason.
Yeah. So here's like my lore building thing on this, which I think is great. They have the elders of the tribe sit down and be for television viewers inducting like a newer member of the tribe. So we got to go over some things that seem pretty basic. But we learn that it has discharge into the water, which is gross. It's a gross way of putting it, but that's how it is. Which explains why it seems like it manifests a lot more in things involving water, at least both in the book and in both adaptations of the book so far. And we learn that they are very much aware of these cycles and that they end in something they call the augury, which is the big event, the big mass casualty event, which is comes towards the end of a cycle, which I think is very interesting.
Sure.
The parts that sort of made me think about the movement's involvement is this, is it seems like when they talk about Hank escaping on the news and when Hank's on the phone with Ingrid, that something attacked that bus. So was it keeping Hank in Derry because it has been building an augury? Like, is an augury a mass event caused by the people, or is an augury an event of it is awake and discharging enough over a period of time that the people of Derry just hit like a mass infection point, and that's what triggers like an augury?
I mean, I guess I instantly, especially when I heard the thing about the bus being attacked, my immediate assumption was that it has something to do with it.
Yeah.
You know, like it is orchestrating a situation where it creates this sort of rising tension in the town. And again, I think we talked about this last week. It's using whatever the tension of the time is. And it'll be interesting to see if this show explores this deeper, if it gets to multiple seasons and goes back to the other big events. But it's like it's using the sort of racial politics of the 1960s, you know, in the civil rights movement to create this sort of firestorm in the town that will create what would look like to an outsider as just another, you know, vignette of America in that moment, but is really, you know, the clown doing shit. So yeah, I definitely think the clown is involved in freeing Hank. It wants Hank out. It wants the town to be angrily looking for him because that spreads them out and makes the entire situation more vulnerable for everyone. And it also distracts the town, right? Like if the whole goal of it is during this leading up to the augury is to be able to snatch and eat children, what better way to distract the adults than a massive manhunt for, you know, someone they think has killed the children and, you know, they're not even looking for the clown. So it's I wouldn't put it past Pennywise to have, especially because we know, you know, it can be in multiple places at once. So it could be doing the bus stuff. It could be terrorizing the soldiers in the sewer and terrorizing the kids in the sewer, kind of all at the same time, if it wants to be.
It also has, we learned that Hank was telling the truth to Charlotte about hooking up with a white woman. That woman is Ingrid Kirsch, who seems to be, at the end of the episode, at least partially invested in helping Hank. And Hank is going to call Charlotte. It seems like that's what the hinting is going on for. In how much it influenced I be on the watch for in terms of that whole thing happening, because we talked about earlier when you had a theory that he actually was doing something that could also be it influenced in some sort of way. Like the fact that he doesn't have an alibi and it is this racially insensitive alibi has the makings of it inflaming the passions of the time. So I guess that's a way to sort of pivot into what did you think about the Miss Kirsch reveal, the Ingrid Kirsch reveal?
Yeah, I mean, it further points. I mean, we know we think we know who Mrs. Kirsch becomes because we've seen it chapter two.
Yes.
And that she is tied to the clown in some way. So it's entirely possible that this is, even this affair has been an orchestration of the entity, and that its entire plan is to use Hank to create this division in the town. And it's funny because we're watching this in tandem with also watching Hannibal, and it's one of those things where it's like we're constantly asking ourselves, is Hannibal playing the long game? Did he have these plans all along, or is he sort of freewheeling it? You kind of do the same dance with Pennywise, where it's like, did he know that he could inflame the racial tension of the town by pinning the murders on Hank, or did he just see Hank as an easy fall guy for the initial kid snatching?
Yeah.
And then he sort of lucked into this situation where now the entire town is going to be up in arms about it. I think either way it works out in its favor. So
yeah,
kind of doesn't matter, but you know, we should not be trusting Mrs. Kirsch. For sure.
There's some things I noticed in this episode that then revealed Mrs. Kirsch. The things that surprised me were like the Hank thing, honestly. Her telling Lily not to go into the sewers, obviously. And sort of like the portrayal of Cleaver Kirsch, her husband, as sort of this malevolent shadow force that then doesn't want his stake burnt. All of those things.
Oh, yeah. His vibes are abusive 1960s husband.
Yes.
Yeah. Like this is TV language for, if that kid wasn't there, that conversation would have been far worse for Mrs. Kirsch.
So in previous episodes, I'm like, that woman doesn't have a reflection. All of these things play as in like she's actually a character. So that made me think that she's also one of the characters who is old enough, if she does end up being related to Periwinkle, that clown in 1908, but at least judging on the actress's real age and the age of the actor who plays General Shaw, who are, you know, within a few years of each other, it is possible that this character is one of the legacy characters who, if we have future seasons, we could see more about how this person got to this situation. So her being expanded into a character, on one hand, it would be super devious of Pennywise to be orchestrating this entire thing around Hank and sort of using Mrs. Kirsch as a tool, if you will, a Henry Bowers-esque tool,
right?
Who is a human that has like some sort of thing. But on the other hand, it could be much more traumatizing where she isn't like a willing Renfield-like character to compare it to Dracula, but is a unwilling sort of participant because she is also trapped. She actually does love Hank, and it won't let Hank out of the out of Derry, and like she is somewhat aware of that or some such thing. I'm just wondering how complex they want this character to be, given the fact that, unlike the children, she is a character that could appear in season two.
Right. Right. Well, and we've discussed like the potential of her being related somehow to the form that Pennywise has stolen. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe she's being manipulated by that form. Right.
Right.
Instead of
which, based on the movie, may not even be her father.
Yeah. And she may not even necessarily know that that's the entity. She may just think that that's her father.
We're gonna have to find out.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have the King Verse Easter egg of the week corner, which is, I think, hands down, everything that happens to Dick Halloran after he falls down a sewer hole.
Mm-hmm.
Because all of that is light The Shining, but pulled almost directly from Dr. Sleep, where we have the grandpa who was very abusive. They call him the black grandpa and the white grandma, not because of their skin color, but because of like their souls. So the white grandma is the one that has the shining, mm-hmm. that is trying to educate Dick, and who eventually teaches him how to put spirits into a box to sort of stop them from haunting him at inappropriate times. And the grandpa was the first of the spirits that appeared, the black grandpa, who would, you know, menace the entire family when he was alive, and would also walk around with like that pistol sticking out of his waistband. So the second the dude with the pistol sticking out of his waistband brings in a box with chains around it and a lock, which is also how it's described in the book Dr. Sleep, not in the film adaptation Dr. Sleep, I was like, oh my God, this is like so much information that for me reads instantly. I'm interested to see how this scene plays out to communicate to like other people who haven't seen Dr. Sleep recently,
mm-hmm.
about what's happening.
Yeah.
So I want to talk a lot about Dick Halloran in this episode, but I do want to start hearing your perspective by asking the question from the end, which is, what's in the box?
Well, it's interesting because, first of all, I felt very prepared for this because of this podcast. So I hope that everyone else listening felt as prepared as I was, because I immediately knew who that was. I immediately knew what that box was, and I kind of knew what would happen if they opened that box. And I was immediately skeptical, right? Like that, obviously that was Pennywise and not the spirit of his actual grandfather, because I assumed, right. the spirit of his actual grandfather was inside the box.
Because it has to be, if the story is still sticking to canon.
Until the last scene when he sees the ghost. And then they show the box, and the box has this like light inside of it. Because for a second there, I was like, is this show trying to communicate to me that he put either a portion of or the majority of his shining in the box?
Mm-hmm.
Because he wouldn't have been able to put, what's the guy's name? Russo? Paulie?
Yeah.
He wouldn't have been able to put that guy in the box. But he would have not been able to see ghosts if he put his ability in the box.
Right.
Or a part of his ability. Because we've seen him obviously use some of his psychic abilities, some of his shine abilities. But it seems like what Dick Halloran put in the box was the part of his ability that allows him to communicate with the spirits that are around him. Right. And he kept, the only piece that he kept outside the box was his ability to flip through people's minds like the phone book, apparently. So I think that now that it's open, not only is he going to see the spirits of people who have died on the show, which is fun because that means, you know, especially for those kid actors who died in the first episode, they might get to come back, talk to Dick for a little bit. But I also think that it sets up, at least for me, the very frightening potential that we may actually encounter the spirit of his grandfather, which would be even more terrifying than what we see in this episode. Because what we see in this episode is Pennywise impersonating his grandfather in order to get the box open.
Right.
But I assume that whatever was in the box is worse.
Yeah. I have a similar reading to you. I went back and watched the part of Dr. Sleep where he explains the box to Danny. And Danny starts off saying, like, I don't understand why the Overlook was dangerous to me. You told me they were like pictures in a book, which means they wouldn't be able to hurt him. And Dick's like, to me, the Overlook was always like pictures in a book. But because you shine so much, they sort of like came out into reality for you.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, what was in the box is like the extra part of the shine that puts Dick over the edge.
Mm-hmm.
Like he could tap in maybe like the mind reading stuff. He could do some sort of tracking if he has like an object. But it used to be he was like a raw nerve. The mm-hmm. dead would show up, you know, things with psychic powers like it, or in the Dr. Sleep parlance, the true knot or something would show up. And so in order to like tamp that thing down, you got to put some of your shining in the box. You got to hide your shine away to say the term.
Yeah. You have to put a dampener on your shine by removing some of it and putting it in the box. But now that it's open, it's going to be a rough ride for Dick, I imagine.
But also Pennywise being able to get into the box, that does make me wonder if, like, you're correct. The grandfather comes out of the box and it's actually the grandfather, like the shining ghost, the grandfather.
Yeah.
Or if Pennywise had access to the box, like was Pennywise accessing Dick's still existing memory of his grandfather? Or was he able to peek into the box because it has a power to sort of like also harness the shining?
Mm-hmm.
We talked about how maybe Dick saw some of the future when he looked into the deadlights, when he was sort of like tracking Pennywise to begin with. So maybe, again, Pennywise sees that Dick is more interesting, maybe a delicious adult meal, and so has sent him out to sort of marinate in fear for a little while, which I imagine also disables a very powerful weapon against Pennywise, which could have been Dick if Dick had kept his shit together.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. That is one of the reasons why it allows Dick to leave the sewer, is that not only is it going to allow Dick Halloran's mind to marinate in fear for a while here, but I imagine if this goes poorly for Dick Halloran, it's going to freak the people around him out even more. Right. Basically everybody but Major Hanlon.
Right.
But as we see in this episode, Pennywise also seems to have a strategy for Major Hanlon, which is to present him with confusing images of people he loves and try to get him to shoot his own family. So,
yeah. Love is a diametric opposite to fear, but still the same weapon, I think, is a hidden, really smart idea in this episode that nobody says out loud. But they definitely have it on their mind, because in the making of episode 5 featurette that came after the episode, both the director and Andy Muschietti talk about how, like, Shaw is the only one who thinks Halloran doesn't have any fear. Like, Halloran has fear. Just mm-hmm. because he doesn't have, like, the scientific chemical definition of fear doesn't mean it's incapable of reaching him, because it is now using its family against him. And almost successfully gets him to murder a member of his family, which mm-hmm. fear or not, you know, that triggers a whole other well of emotions that it probably could have fed on as well.
Yeah.
That being said, I do feel like the Polly death's a little lame. This dude went to a war in like Korea and survived a plane explosion and came back, and his friend shoots him in a secret sewer operation. He's like, this is how I wanted to go out. I'm like, I don't think that's how anybody wants to go out.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like there's some context that we're missing here that maybe we'll get if we get to talk to his ghost. Because he says, the very interesting thing that he says is, it's my turn, which I interpreted as him saying to Major Hanlon, it's my turn to save you. Kind of like
right.
Hanlon saved him in Korea. So it's this idea that, you know, this very soldierly idea of honor, that like, this man saved me in war, I get to save him and his son here in this moment. And this is, you know, a warrior's death, I guess. It's sad because he's just getting shot in a sewer in Maine. But, you know, I think it also does for these two characters become this very important moment of, I guess, punctuating their friendship.
Right.
So but I do think it'll be really interesting if we get further context for that. And especially now that we know that Dick can see the ghost of Pauly, will he be able to have conversations back and forth with between Pauly and Hanlon? And will we get any sort of further context for that? But I mean, I like the way that this is executed up to the death, right?
Right.
Like them being in the sewer. Well,
because as it's coming and like Will is running slow motion, you're like, oh my God, it's going to happen.
Yeah. Because I was very convinced that one of these kids was going to get shot. And especially after last week, when we talked specifically about one of them that we don't think is going to make it, I was like, oh shit, here it comes.
Right. That serves you right for holding hands.
Yeah. But I think this is that it was a really cool way to do it, where he's like, oh no, they're real. And he sort of just jumps in front of it like that. So it's, you know, deeply traumatizing for everyone else involved. And I'll be curious to see what role his ghost has to play in the rest of this story. Because I think that's one thing that I had not even really considered going into this series, especially because that's not really part of what we see in the movies, or, you know, the 1989 period. There's several things that this story has added that I don't feel that the more modern day part of the It story had, right?
Right.
Which is obviously The Shining, having somebody there who can shine. And then the concept of the augury, because correct me if I'm wrong, but like there isn't like a bloodbath at the end of the 1989 cycle.
It gets stopped by kids both times.
So,
or like the losers, I guess.
So I am curious to see if the show addresses that. If there's something that happens in this 1960s cycle that sort of, I don't know, because we've been talking about whether or not the clown can win, right? Obviously the clown can't lose entirely because it has to come back in 27 years.
Yeah.
But is there something about this cycle that changes the rhythm or changes the level of power that the clown, that the entity has, that allows for there not to be a mass casualty event at the end of the next cycle?
I think that's a good question. I think they could do nothing with it and just say the losers stopped it from an augury both times.
Sure.
But I also think in the lore is a trap vein, we could be, and in the It Chapter 2 Ritual of Chud vein, we could be putting a lot of our narrative hopes on something that ultimately has no power over it whatsoever. Like we have this idea of this set of rules that it is living by, but it might be much more of a detente. So we, at least in It Chapter 1 and It Chapter 2, we don't get any mention of these pillars.
Right.
And we don't get any mention of this dragon glass weapon dagger. We do get mention of that sort of basket that they use to try to put the deadlights in It Chapter 2. So that also has not appeared here, which means it is very possible, I think, that we get the augury in the black spot and then it keeps going and people are like, I thought we knew what the rules were. And it's like, no, you brought me the U.S. military and now I have a bunch of ideas. Mm-hmm. And that could be what sort of allows it to expand. And so it makes the losers much more impressive, because not only did they defeat it, but they defeated an it that gets more powered up by this prequel rather than powered down with lore, which again, I love the lore. I'm a very lore-centric person. There's a lot of lore in It, the novel, that just the movies were not interested in. So I appreciate that that's the way the show's going, but I also appreciate that it could be a trap that this show is luring me into.
Sure.
to be like, be super interested in this. You too think you could defeat Pennywise. Well, too bad. And then we, you know, all the rules that we thought we got changed, which has already happened to us because before we got this augury language, like a couple episodes, I was basing it off a fan wiki that thought these large mass casualty events were awakening events.
Yeah.
And even here with the augury, it doesn't make sense how it can go away after the summer of 1908, after apparently having an augury during the Ironworks, which would be in Easter, which would be in the spring. So
right.
We've got rules, but the rules already have contradictions based on what we know about them. So I'm very paranoid about the new rules. Speaking of paranoid about the new rules, Maddie shows up this episode. And the thing that really interested me about Maddie before the transformation is this idea that it was hunting during the day or hunting during the night and sleeping during the day, mm-hmm. which is apparently wrong because Maddie's there.
Which we already knew from this show. This show has shown us is not true because in the flashback when Kid Shaw and Kid Rose encounter him, it's fucking middle of the day. In the woods. So like, it's not unless, you know, it changes over time. I was very skeptical about this.
Then it has the horrible bit about Susie being left to bleed out without an arm, which
could very well be true
to me, but also could be a horrible tale. It had the bit where it ate Teddy's brains in front of Maddie, who was still alive. And that's what got me sort of thinking. The way this sort of made sense to me while it was happening before I realized Maddie was a manifestation of it was it sounds a little bit more like a spider where like it captures you and mm-hmm. it throws you in a web, but it's not eating you all at once.
Sure.
It's not like devouring or whatnot. And this is a unique idea to the It movie adaptations by the Muschietti's, which we talked about when we were covering them, getting ready for the series. But in the books and in the previous adaptations, Stuttering Bill like knows his brother's dead. They found like mm-hmm. bits of him. He bled out. You know, they ripped an arm off, and his brother's dead. In the movies, his brother just goes missing, and that's what sort of it uses to lure the losers into the sewer, ultimately.
Yeah.
And that's what it uses to lure the losers into the sewer here. So the only person that I know that we've ever seen actually go down there and come out alive is Bev, because she gets blinked by the deadlights,
yeah.
and Ben wakes her up with a kiss. How much should I take into account about Pennywise's feeding cycles? Do you think he keeps some kids? Do you think he's just instantly eating these kids? Well, how does it read to you?
It did make a certain amount of sense to me because, you know, as we see in the movies, the whole idea of like them being the you know, dead kids being down there floating in the right. sewer, to me reads as him keeping snacks for later, potentially. And especially the way he like deadlights Bev, you could see a situation where he captures a bunch of the kids, he deadlights a bunch of them, floats them there until he's ready, until he is hungry, basically.
Yeah.
And then eats them. So I think that could be part of it. Whether or not those kids could be saved or are even alive at that point is, you know, a whole nother question, right? I mean, that could just be his meat freezer at that point. And so I think that, you know, there's probably a crumb of truth to that, but yeah, I think once you're down in the sewer for a certain amount of time, unless you're rescued immediately after being hit with the deadlights, you're not making it out, I don't think.
Yeah.
You know, like I think that's the only reason why Bev gets rescued is because like minutes later her friends show up and rescue her. She's not down there for days like Georgie would have been, you know.
Right.
Or I guess in that case Georgie was down there for like a year before they ever sort of got to
Georgie was down there for a bit,
yeah.
And like ultimately realizing that Georgie's dead is Bill's like climax moment in it chapter one, so I understand, you know, why they made that change, but it does make me wonder once again, we're left to wonder, like the kids, can you rescue something that's been taken by it?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Unless it lets you go, like it lets Dick go at the end of this episode. I think once it has you, you're kind of screwed. So I'm maybe prematurely, but this is, you know, I'm going to shoot with my heart, as Stephen King would have me do, and say that I think fake death might be off the table for me for the rest of this episode. I think all the deaths are going to be real.
Yeah.
I think we already rang that possible twist out of existence.
I think the rule that we could safely apply at this point is, especially for the TV show, is if they go down into the sewers, if they don't come back out of the sewer in the same episode, they're dead.
Yeah.
Right. Like in this episode, you know, the kids go down in the sewer. Some of the soldiers go down in the sewer. The ones who survive are out of the sewer by the end of this episode. So
yes, that makes sense.
Everyone who's still down there, including, unfortunately, I think Daniel, I don't think they're coming out because now they're just stuck down there.
Well, before we get to Daniel, let's get to popping that polygon balloon. I think the centerpiece here, of course, is the Maddie transformation, or the Down with the Clown song and sort of reverse swinging around the pole. I have a guess at how that's accomplished. My guess would be you got a 3D scan of Bill Skarsgård as Pennywise, and then you sort of motion track with that thing sort of popping out in certain places, and then some clever editing and a cool lens effect to make the lines of light sort of burst out from behind Pennywise, and you have a full reveal. But it really worked for me. How'd it work for you, Neil?
I thought it worked really well. I think the especially cool part of it is as he's like swinging around and singing the song, the first little part where his like head just sort of bursts open, it splits open into like the little jaws of the clown for a second to just immediately signal that something is wrong, as if him singing that song wasn't enough. And as if him backing up slowly out of the water as the dead bodies were floating up wasn't enough. but I love the transition, and I love the way that it matches to a certain extent the way Pennywise appears later to Lily when he like bursts out as Pickle Dad again. Where it's like it's sort of this like bubbling effect that they get, where it's like you have this character who we think is one thing, and then the entity sort of just like bubbles out of them. It's neat, and I thought was very intensely creepy, and I imagine it caught a lot of people off guard, right? Like you would be completely forgiven if you thought for most of this episode that Maddie was still alive, because I do think the show does a pretty good job of hiding it up until that moment. And again, doing enough to distract you from the fact that this is a very suspicious situation by, like, you know, bringing the soldiers and the kids into the sewer at the same time and creating this additional layer of danger. You kind of forget to be weary of Maddie, and then we get this transformation, and it's pretty awesome. And I think, you know, one of the things that we've been praising about this show, especially me, the person who does not like the clown, is the restraint, especially in comparison to what Andy Muschietti did in the two movies, which was so much clown. The amount of restraint that they had to wait until episode 5 to bring Pennywise out, and to wait until this specific moment to let him sort of burst forth in his more recognizable form, I think was really cool. And I think just it adds to the impact of that moment, because
you know,
imagine just being like a casual viewer who isn't digging into the lore like we are, or isn't even listening to our podcast. And they're just like, oh, where the hell is the clown? You know, through this whole show, and then all of a sudden, boom, there's the clown. And it's pretty good. I bet it some people, their buttholes got real tight for a second.
I am also fascinated that when the idea of it being a clown is introduced by Maddie in the stormpipe. We had seen Will say that it's a clown with that picture, but that picture's silhouette is definitely different from Pennywise's silhouette.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that it is the Pennywise version of the clown is introduced by Pennywise himself, which leads me back to some stuff Andy Muschietti says before the season came out about how this season we're going to learn why Pennywise is its favorite form. So I do like that it sort of is its own hype man, mm-hmm. this episode, as it lures the kids back down into the sewer. And then I think another great thing is for those of us that are used to Pennywise, it doesn't slow play a lot of the Pennywise classics. Now that we've gotten to Pennywise, the Pennywise classics are here. Pretty specifically with Lily, we get transformation into Pickle Dead. Mm-hmm. We get the speed rush forward, and then we get the, eating Georgie face, yeah. where the multiple teeth come out, that is stopped by the glowing object in the sewer. Maybe I understand that it is looking at that, and it, when it switches back to Bill Skarsgård Pennywise face, it looks very disturbed by that. I'm also noticing that Lily is holding up her charm bracelet, and they've made sure that the turtle is out front.
Oh, okay, that I did not catch.
I've been looking for the charm bracelet turtle because I thought that maybe Miss Kirsch had stolen it before, but definitely it is still there. And she puts it up in front of her face, and it is about the same time that the dragonglass dagger activates. So that's an interesting thing to think about. But first of all, I want to clear up stuff with this dragonglass dagger. After just how are the classic Pennywise polygons working for you? I think it feels pretty much like cinema quality in terms of I've seen him do those tricks before, and this is what that looks like.
Yeah, I would say this is on par with some of the best stuff that we saw in the movie. I feel like the end of that is a practical effect. Like I feel right. Like it seemed like the transformation that he goes through is digital, but when his face freezes, that looks extremely real. Like the frozen in with the teeth out and stuff. If that's digital, that's very impressive is what I'm saying. Because that looks like somebody spent a lot of time, you know, painting that and making that as a prosthetic. So I would be very impressed if that frozen version is a digital effect. Either way, super impressive, very cool moment to have him stop right there, right when we think he's about to get Lily, who I think at this point has been established as our sort of main protagonist of the show. And I didn't catch the turtle thing, but that's really interesting because what you're suggesting here, Dave, is that maybe all of this dragon glass pillar stuff is kind of a red herring.
Yeah, man, I'm confused about what actually happened in that scene. And so let's see if we could track it. They last episode, Dick Halloran went into Daniel's mind. We picked that up at the beginning of this episode. Dick Halloran's like, oh, we got it. But when Rose goes to visit Daniel, it seems like they didn't get it. They got something else. And I thought at that point, Daniel was luring them just straight to it, basically like feeding it. And he was able to do that through Dick's like mind trick, which is pretty impressive. Then Rose gives him like the shard, which I think is interesting because the military thinks they go down into Newbold Street. They follow Daniel and Dick. That'll bring them to the 13 pillar artifacts. And then they could start bringing the pillar artifacts into Newbold Street, like tightening a noose around it.
Right. But then they take all of that to Russia.
Right. That's the plan.
I guess that's the plan.
But if Daniel gets the shard from Rose, then that is not one of the pillars, at least that we know about.
Right.
Unless they have one of the pillars already and Rose has been keeping it.
No, this seems like the same dagger that the indigenous girl in the flashback had.
Correct. So I've been calling it the cat's paw dagger because it's important dragon glass.
Cool. Yeah.
So that's if the cat's paw dagger is
the only
is
thing that can kill the Night King.
Uh-huh. If the cat's paw dagger, this is from Game of Thrones, another HBO show that I think has some echoes here in the sense that we're probably going to get a penultimate battle episode, but not important. it gets stopped maybe here by the charm bracelet, but it definitely wants us to think by this glowing dagger that I think is the one that Tanyel drops in the sewer and then Lily picks it up.
Okay.
Because if Lily picked up a pillar, like it seems like that was very fortunate that she ran there, that she ran to the outskirts of Derry from whatever entrance she was coming towards. And that she happened across one of 13 things that could have stopped it.
Yeah.
And she sort of like picked it up and was able to move it.
Yeah.
I think the episode wants me to think she found the cat's paw dagger, not that she found one of the pillars.
Yeah. Well, and initially this was a very confusing thing for me because even though I watched this episode twice, for some reason I missed the part where Tanyel drops the shard. So yeah. The first time I watched this, assumed that she did in fact find one of the pillars. But the more I think about it, the more that doesn't make sense, because the pillars are buried underground. Why would it be in the water in the sewer? Right? Like, what, did it float up on its own?
That seems very unsafe.
Right. Like, even if the pillars are in this network of tunnels, they're still buried. Like, we literally watched them bury them in the ground. So it does stand to reason that it is the dagger. But now that we've been talking about it even further, maybe it is a red herring. Maybe it is this idea that, and listen, this, there's a part of me that very much wants to see the turtle god.
Right.
Like, very much wants to see the turtle god. I will suffer the clown if I get to see the turtle god. So if it really is Pennywise reacting to the charm on her bracelet of the turtle, that would be fun. And he also does say duck and cover to the kids, like, which is sort of a reference to the video, the film that the kids were watching that had the turtle in it. So I don't know. Especially now that we've established that this show has no problem lying to us.
Yes, we're getting teased by the turtle. All I'm saying is that we were introduced the idea that the pillars are a barrier.
Right.
And yet we're supposed to believe in this scene that the dagger is a barrier, which is not how we're told the dagger has been used at all.
Right.
So I'm a little confused as to, because they made a big deal out of it last episode, showing like at first there was a dagger, then there were the pillars.
Sure.
So I think you're correct that this is the OG dagger, which has been handed down like as a weapon.
And it is possible that the entity is afraid of the dagger.
Yes, right. Because otherwise Rose gave it to Tanyel basically to protect Tanyel. Mm-hmm. So it does have some sort of protection thing.
Sure. And well, in the flashback, the reason why the rest of the tribe got basically almost massacred by the entity was because the kids ran off with the dagger.
Right.
So.
And tried to like find more, also because it got powerful, so it can maybe overcome the dagger. Sure. I'm very confused. Either way, it looks like starting next episode, the kids are going to have this dagger. So I think we're going
to get them
some more rules. It was just a very fun moment for me to I rewatched it a lot because I do think the polygons look great, especially on that frozen spot if it's not a model. So I watched that a lot. I love how it retreats and sort of like the deadlights sort of like bounce back. Like they start as the eyes, but then the clown, Bill Skarsgård gives a pretty good retreating performance. And in watching that, I'm like, they put a very thrilling scene around a bunch of MacGuffins not acting like those MacGuffins should act.
Yeah.
So I'm, you know, props for that distraction. Well,
and the other curious thing here, Dave, is that the episode also gives the lore an out for the containment of the entity, which is this idea that the discharge is in the water.
Mm-hmm.
Because the water might not be able to be contained by the pillars. So this would explain, I think, one of the other questions that I've had about these pillars since we learned about them, which is if the entity can't leave the pillars, is the entire town of Derry inside the pillars, or are the pillars not necessarily able to completely contain the entity? And if the entity can get into the water, that might mean that it can get beyond the pillars. Maybe not in its clown form, but it can definitely right. spread some evil outside, you know, just in the drinking water, which is gross. But
where the barrier is very interesting, because HBO did release, I believe, on Instagram, a sort of map of Derry with where the pillars would be. And the pillars surround the town of Derry.
Mm-hmm.
They do not extend beyond the river. So the river is out of bounds, basically, of most of the pillars. And the army base is out of the bounds of the pillars. So that makes sense, at least that the show wants us to believe that, because it has Leroy bring his family onto the base this episode as a right. way of sort of keeping them safe. So the army thinks they're outside of the pillars. Many people have already noted that Mrs. Kerr shows up at the base to collect Charlotte and talk to her. So if Mrs. Kerr was a manifestation, in theory, she wouldn't be able to do that. But as I'm saying, I'm on the prowl that all the lore is a trap, that we think sure. these things are working and they might not be working. And so I love the through the water idea, where you're able to sort of influence things outside of the circle of pillars just by water sapping. I do know that every episode, I know there are 13 pillars, that we don't find at least one pillar. I'm like, there's no way they deal with this.
Yeah.
There's no way there's an episode where every 4 minutes we're finding a pillar, right? Like, I just don't think that's a narratively interesting episode in terms of what they're setting up right yeah. now.
Which means that either the pillars work and the entire conflict has to take place inside of them.
Right.
Or the pillars are, you know, a fake out and they don't work and it doesn't matter. And eventually we're going to see the entity be able to move beyond them, because we know from the movies that the influence of it can extend beyond the limits of Derry. Right.
Right.
Because it is responsible for like why they forget when they move away from Derry. But that doesn't necessarily mean that like the clown can go to like Portland, Maine, if it wants to.
Right.
So.
And this series could end in a lot of ways based on what it's pulling in. Like at the end of this, they could have broken the cage and it, you know, throws part of its consciousness into the mountains of Colorado. I think that's dumb, but that could be something it does mm-hmm. if it wants to, you know, become a Castle Rock of its own. That's a reference to a 2-season Hulu show that's mashed together a bunch of Stephen King properties.
Sure.
Which I wouldn't have compared to Welcome to Derry until this episode. But again, a bunch of Dr. Sleep here
mm-hmm.
In this episode.
I do have another lore question for you.
Yeah.
What do you make of the fact that in this episode, General Shaw named the tribe?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not the same name of the tribe that we find out in It Chapter 2 was doing the ritual of Chud.
I have a couple thoughts about that. One, this tribe is doomed, which is sad, but possible.
Mm-hmm.
Two is that they want to make sure that we differentiate from the ritual of Chud tribe
mm-hmm.
and this tribe, because they're not actually going towards doing a ritual of Chud. This season isn't going to be like, oh, we're going to bring out the basket and see it fail.
Sure.
We know that it fails, but we used to say it was the Shakopee. Now it is not. So maybe we don't know that this Children of Maturin tribe fails in the exact way that we would produce. I would say it's probably like building in suspense in that way.
Sure.
At least that was my initial thought, because I was like, you definitely didn't need to name the tribe.
Mm-hmm.
And if you did, like, you guys wrote the movies, that it's not a mistake that you you now are naming the tribe yeah, as something different.
Like, they're not retroactively changing it. And I do think they haven't really necessarily, I guess at this point, I assume that this tribe is the same tribe that now is like Rose and her people that live outside the town of Derry, and that the Shakopee are gone.
Yeah, that's also possible. The Shakopee just were consumed by it in the
when they failed the ritual, you know, the first time.
Right. That makes sense to me. It's also very possible they're just going to say Mike Hanlon is sort of like has a blind spot towards actual Indigenous history. Because Mike Hanlon in chapter two, he does book-based research, but book-based research does only get you so far.
Sure.
Rose is like actual memory lineage. But I also like that the General Shaw said that this group has been protecting the pillars and people from it for about 400 years. So that gives me a timestamp for when the 13 pillars were established is about 400 years ago. So we have millions of years ago. We have 400 years ago, the sort of floating thing that we probably won't deal with this season would be my guess. But we talked about, I believe in during discussing it, chapter one, was the first beaver trappers who sort of made a settlement on Derry all disappeared, sort of like in a reference to the very real nice real life Roanoke incident where a whole colony kind of disappeared. So we might see that as like a first augury, if you will, or some such thing in the future. Or as you were saying, it deleted a whole tribe that now just got more complex, and that they all got eaten because they tried a ritual, and this other tribe was like, screw rituals, we're gonna make some pillars.
Well, we're not gonna do that again.
Yeah, well, that was a bad idea. Well, let's make a cage instead. But it does, as we notice in this episode, sort of meeting of the Children of Maturin group, they are willing to sacrifice a certain number of children. I believe they said there's already like 20 some victims this cycle, which means there's been some missing children we haven't accounted for.
Certain amount of descendants of the colonizers, let's say.
Yes. As long as it's not them, they're willing to sacrifice some people.
My assumption is that they live completely outside of the pillars. Right? I don't
know.
I mean, Rose's shop is in Derry, but I mean, especially if I were her and I knew what I knew, I would not live in town.
Right. I assume she pulled the shard out of her shop in Derry. I assume that she lived there, but maybe you're right. I guess we haven't seen where these indigenous people live.
Well, and I'm also basing that just on the general knowledge of the history of how the indigenous people of North America were treated. Like, you have the town of Derry that has been fully colonized, and I assume some sort of reservation outside the town where indigenous people have been given land, because they did mention earlier in the season, like, you know, the taxpayers of Derry have paid for all of these nice things like paved roads. When are they going to help us develop the swamp?
Right.
And that sounds like outside of town.
I mean, or it's their thing for the barons, which is very much inside of town. So, I mean, we're going to have to see, but they definitely have us thinking that these people have been watching, whether from inside or close to Derry, for 400 years.
Unfortunately, it does not seem to be on this map that HBO posted. That would have been helpful, HBO.
Yeah, where are the indigenous people? And then, I don't know, are there any other, my one other gripe, I guess, in the episode is in sort of pivoting to a whole bunch of lore. I am a little worried that we now have too many losers that are actually alive. I love the addition of Marge and her scene with Lily at the beginning of the episode to sort of like get her to go back on calling Lily's explanation of what happened to the theater crazy, and now she's, you know, all hands on deck. She's part of Team Loser. I like that a lot. And I like the moment that she gets to hold hands with Rich. That being said, I don't get a lot from Rich here, and I would like a little bit more characterization outside of the person he likes. And then I'm a little worried Ronnie is just a tool for but shouldn't we go to the police and save my dad? Which is a weird place for that character to be in, I think, especially with the racial tones that the series is playing on. Why make the one black girl being the one like, no, we should go to the police over and over again? You know, I think she would, realistically, that character would maybe come around a little bit more since she's also been attacked by the presence that is it.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I'm worried about a lot of these kids.
Yeah. So
I do think that the theory that we talked about in the storm about Marge and Lil Richie is furthered in this episode, but that doesn't make me feel better about his fate potentially. So I think that, you know, but then again, the kids are the ones who, you know, the losers are usually the ones who seem to survive these stories. And what we have, what now that we know that all of the kids from the movie theater are actually dead, right?
Yes.
We're not holding out hope that any of those kids are still alive.
I don't think so.
You know, I think one or two of these losers not making it out seems about right for the rhythm of these stories, and the rest of them sort of surviving in some way.
The one thing I was saying over and over to Java when Tiny Will was slow motion running through the sewer is like, Will has to live. Will has to live.
Yeah.
Will has to live.
Will's the only one that I'm sure has to live beyond his childhood years. Every other one of these kids, as far as I know, does not appear later in the story. So, you know, for all we know, Lily either doesn't make it or spends the rest of her life in Juniper Hill. And I fear that very bad things are going to happen to the entire Grogan family. So, you know, we'll see.
Well, Neil, then let's speculate a little bit about what we might be seeing. Unless you have any objections, I think we should roll over into the storm.
Let's do it.
Well, you got trouble, my friend. Right here, I say trouble right here.
What are you doing in the sewer?
A storm blew me away. Blew the whole circus away.
All right, Neil. I think that we are we're gonna have a twist somewhere.
Okay.
We're gonna have a twist somewhere that is what I'm hinting at, which is none of this stuff is working, and maybe sure. None of it ever worked.
Well, I mean, you know, it's safe to assume that the military plan is not going to work, obviously,
right?
Because even in the story of It, Chapter 1 and 2, America doesn't win the Cold War with the clown. So I think that's going to go badly. It already has started to go badly, but it's going to get even worse when the town starts to, you know, turn on each other and maybe even turn on the military. Who knows?
They're definitely foreshadowing that we're going to, you know, beat at the black spot pretty soon.
Yeah.
And then the augury things, which suggest that's going to cap it off. But we know from the previews and stuff that we have a whole mist sequence where it seems like Pennywise is in the town terrorizing different people. I've come to believe that in the further on this season trailer, the mid-season trailer, when Pennywise says, "I've always wondered how you taste," I'm starting to wonder that. Starting to think that that is General Shaw.
Yeah.
Because Pennywise remembers him from 1908. So I think that's going to be the end of that. My only assumption then coming from that is that because also the series, according to the Muschietti's, is going backwards in time, we have to deal with the pillars now. So we have to nullify the pillars by the end of season one.
Sure. Either by establishing that they weren't as powerful as we were led to believe, or something destroys them.
Yeah. Shaw breaks the cage being selfish somehow and, you know, thinks he's beyond it and it doesn't work.
I mean, that is one thing about this military plan, which is this notion that they want to be able to dig up all the pillars and then shrink the cage in order to capture.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it works like that. You know, like, what if when you dig up one of the pillars, the cage just breaks? Right? Like,
very possible.
How do you know that you can take it and then shrink it like a noose? I think messing with it at all is probably a bad idea.
Yeah. Rose mentions that whatever drug they gave Shaw to make him remember maybe didn't make him remember the full story of whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's possible there's a twist both in its direction and in the indigenous people's direction. The thing that makes me think we're heading to like a doom ending is, again, how much can you change retroactively about It Chapter 1 and It Chapter 2, which is the core story that this is all based on at this moment.
Sure.
The other thing, that one just doesn't have pillars.
The other thing that I noticed in this that I caught on my second watch through of this episode is what Shaw says to Leroy sort of at the end of the episode, which is, you know, the people who led us down there, led us into this, are going to pay or face mm-hmm. some accountability, which means that they're going to become antagonistic towards the indigenous people, which I feel like is also kind of dangerous because, you know, regardless of what Taniel's intentions were when they went down into the sewer, whether he was trying to take them right to the clown or whether he was actually trying to take them to the pillars, they do know where the pillars are.
Yeah.
So if they wanted to, let's say, move some of the pillars themselves so that the clown could get to the military base, they could do that.
That seems like trying to direct the clown, which Rose seems against, but I think you're right.
But, you know, also if she's forced into people. That situation, right? You know, if they're threatening her, her family, her tribe, and the safety of everyone who has been protected by these pillars, she may have to take some extreme action against Shaw and his plan.
I do like this idea that Shaw is going to be the antagonist to these children of Maturin, and that's what's going to like break the cage. Because I do think, yeah, something about this lore isn't lining up because we haven't heard about it before. Mm-hmm. And again, a lot of it could be hand waved away by like Mike Hanlon in It Chapter 2 just did research about things that you write about, and all sure. histories are just by the winners who write them.
Yeah, I mean,
it's going to win this.
If he's reading it in history books, he's reading history books written by the colonizers, not necessarily written by the scholars of
right.
the indigenous tribes. So,
or by another tribe that is not this tribe, apparently, that we see in this iteration. Mm-hmm. So wherever yeah. Mike got his information, it's from different places. Than
for all we know, happening. We are watching the story of how this tribe gets wiped out.
Yeah, very, very possible.
Which is would be very sad.
I mean, it would be very sad, but it would also set up this like domino effect where right now in this season of Welcome to Derry, we're telling the story closest to the losers, but we're also getting some hints about characters that could appear further back and et cetera, et cetera. So sort of this telling stories in reverse involves the placement of climaxes in ways that they tease further stories. It's like a prequel-minded way mm-hmm. of thinking, but I've been very impressed with it so far. All right. We know that episode 7 is called The Black Spot,
mm-hmm.
and it has since been revealed that the finale episode, episode 8, is called Winter Fire.
Mm.
And involves at least the fog taking over Derry. That's in the final episode description. Mm-hmm. And it says General Shaw continues to try to execute his plan. So we know also Shaw's making it to the conclusion, which is why I've shifted wholeheartedly to the always wondered how you taste is to Shaw, not to Marge, like I thought.
Sure.
But Marge is in the fog mm-hmm. in the trailers. We've seen Marge with Lily and Ronnie, and they still have the shard in the trailers. So that seems like it's going to make it all the way through. We don't see little Ronnie still in the fog sequence.
Mm.
And Winterfire in the It Chapter 1 things are the It Chapter 1 and Chapter 2 is the poem that Ben writes Bev. And we know that there's a Chekhov's poem gun written in the bottom of Rich's sneaker to Marge. So I think we might put Rich in danger at the black spot. But now I'm starting to think Rich might be an inciting incident for the kids being like, screw this clown. We're going into the fog
mm-hmm.
In the finale episode.
Yeah. Well, and it makes sense that potentially Ronnie would be in danger when the things go over at the black spot, because it all does seem to be building that the black spot is where they're going to try and hide Hank.
Right. So that is in the episode description. So next week's episode is in the name of the father. The description is plagued by increasingly dark visions. Dick learns the black spot is integral to Charlotte's plan, which I think is interesting because increasingly dark visions means we're going to spend some time. And I think the episode 6 trailer shows this with whatever's happened to Dick Mm-hmm. Now that his box has been opened, this probably leads to the drinking, because drinking dulls the shine, and he's going to need some dulling if he's just become like an open wound again. But I also think that Dick learns the black spot is integral to Charlotte's plan is interesting, because Charlotte does have reason to talk to Dick, and Dick is involved in the black spot. But also, if Dick's an open shining thing, somebody else could tell him this, or like he could have a vision of the black spot, as he does in the It novel, mm-hmm. where Dick is able to save some people from the black spot because he sees it coming.
Mm-hmm.
So we got that going down. But then also in the trailer breakdown, there's Bowers sort of rallying all of the racists, being like, I know where he's hidden in the bar. I believe the bar is called the Falcon, that we saw sort of the other racists kicking Dick's friends out of earlier in the season. We see sort of a gathering at the school, which looks like a bunch of people bringing their guns and like a red pickup truck in the daytime to sort of like gather, form a posse, if you will. Which looks like it's going to be the posse that we've seen burn down the black spot. But that being said, episode 7 is called The Black Spot. I think we've got a build to, as I was alluding to in the calm, an HBO-esque battle episode. I think The Black Spot is going to be a bit more of an affair than the other scare sequences in this show, because I think ultimately it's an HBO show.
Sure.
How are you feeling about that timeline?
I mean, I think that makes sense. And I do think that we have more stuff to flashback and establish, especially if, as we were talking about in the calm, a lot of this has been orchestrated by the entity, right? Then I think this is a good spot for them to double back, especially because this episode's called In the Name of the Father, to explaining what's up with Mrs. Kirsch. What that has to do with Bob Gray, because I'm pretty sure I spotted him in the trailer for next week's episode.
Indeed.
And I'm pretty sure I heard Bill Skarsgård's non-Pennywise voice in the trailer for next week's episode. So I feel like this is where we get the story of maybe how he chose that form and what it has to do with Mrs. Kirsch. And maybe this is where we reveal a little bit more about how much of the events that we've seen so far were part of its plan all along. And that sort of leads us up to this sense of, maybe we end episode 6 with a sense of doom that this town has been completely manipulated into this situation where they're all about to kill each other. And for no good reason, you know? Like, because the clown wants them to kill each other. And you know, racism, obviously. You know, there's that too. But the clown has exploited that underlying racism of the time to create this now very dangerous augury situation. And I also kind of think it's interesting that they planted the augury seed here, because maybe it's a fake out too. Like, maybe the black spot isn't the augury. Maybe it is the fog that we see later.
Right.
And I think that's kind of fun as well, where like we get this really big gnarly episode about this horrific fire and conflict within the town. And that's not even the worst thing that the clown does.
Yeah.
That would be a very it thing to do, you know?
Definitely. So here's my guess. Episode 6 is called In the Name of the Father because we are going to get the Mrs. Kirsch reveal. But I still think, because it is more interesting if this is a character, and we talked about it in the storm last week, this is also a way of doing Bill Skarsgård in previous seasons without necessarily making him the clown.
Yeah.
Is that she's a real person like Henry Bowers in the books, is being influenced by what she sees as a version of her father.
Right.
And that is the Bob Gray version of it. And she is the character Periwinkle, who is the little girl with the bells on the three-pointed wig, because we've seen Periwinkle in Mike's photograph and outside Mike's house, where if you enhance those, that is different from the silhouette that is eventually manifest by Pennywise here. And then in the episode 6 trailer, we get a shot of somebody in full Periwinkle costume, it looks like, in that attic space we've seen Lily around in, which we've speculated is where she's going to find out about Mrs. Kirsch. My question, I guess, with that is, how do you think it is she's going to be a character being influenced by Pennywise so we could use her in new seasons? Or do you think this is, like you were saying before, an influence all the way back to Hank Grogan?
I mean, if Pennywise has been able to take the form of her father all the way back since like 1908,
mm-hmm.
then I think that it's possible that she's unaware that she's being manipulated.
Oh, okay.
Or I guess I don't really understand the full extent of the deadlights. Like, is it possible that when the entity took over the form of Bob Gray, which could have been like her actual real father back in the day, could he have like deadlit her in a way that created this sort of subordinate person that she's like not entirely aware that she is, you know, like in her mind, her father's just like still alive and around and, mm-hmm. and you know, in her life. But in reality, it's the clown. I think that could be one possibility. We could also find out that she is, even though she's a corporeal entity, she has been fully corrupted and she's just evil, and that everything she's been doing, you know, whether it's encouraging Lily to stick with her friends or telling Lily, don't go in the sewers, knowing that Lily would totally go in the sewers because kids do exactly the opposite of what you tell them. That she has been knowingly, to a certain extent, manipulating the kids the entire time, right? And that this has been a long form setup that could even date back before Hank Grogan, right? Like, this could have this plan could have been forming since like the death of Lily's father,
right?
You know, since the first time Lily was at Juniper Hill.
My question would be, is if how aware is she? Yeah, like you're sort of saying, how aware is she of the fact she's being manipulated? Because like, is it weird to her that her father only shows up every 27 years?
Mm-hmm.
Like it seems like there's another degree of complicity in this.
Yeah,
especially if she's dressing up as her clown persona and sneaking around where it things are happening.
Yeah,
so we're gonna have to see what version of that. However, it could all be very television-y.
I wouldn't be surprised, especially because of what we know of how Mrs. Kirsch ends up in It Chapter 2 as literally like a monster, that she's being like puppeted by the clown at this point. That like the original version of Mrs. Kirsch, the original human version of her is gone. And that this version of Mrs. Kirsch is an extension of the entity, even though she is still physically a body. He's sort of controlling everything she's doing, including getting into this relationship with Hank at the right time to be able to, you know, put these murders on him.
Yeah. Also very interesting. There is a shot of Pennywise supposedly at the black spot, but he's surrounded by flames and he's holding a cleaver, which is of course the nickname of Cleaver Kirsch, the husband. So it is possible that she is being manipulated from lots of different places, sure. Lots of different versions of it.
Maybe he's also the husband.
It's who knows how complicit Ingrid is, but I think next episode is our episode to find out.
That guy is weird. Like the vibes are off with the guy with her husband, because you know, the conversation that he has with Charlotte when we first meet him is very different than the tone of what we see in this most recent episode where Lily encounters him. And it's such an extreme turn where, I mean, I know it could be as simple as the show wanting us to read that he is nice in public and abusive in private. But it's also really, you know, suspicious to the extent that he's kind of not acting like a human would.
Right. So. The rest of the description is, meanwhile, Will faces his parents' disapproval for walking into a dangerous situation.
Sure.
Mara stands up to the patty cakes and Lily's behavior grows erratic. So I think Lily's behavior grows erratic will be her discovering the stuff in Mrs. Kirsch's attic, and that sort of screaming while riding the bike moment from the trailers. But also in the episode 6 trailer, she seems to be talking to the kids about maybe using the cat's paw dagger shard as like a weapon. And at least in the trailer, it's glowing. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, isn't glowing bad? Isn't glowing like Sting from The Hobbit, where like it's only glowing if the troll is around? So I don't know what to think about those shots existing for next week's episode.
Yeah. Well, and I think that it does sort of set up a situation where the town's already kind of on edge. The adults in the town are on edge. And they're already very suspicious of Lily because of what's happened so far. So if she continues down this path and from the outside seemingly looks crazier and crazier, it gets closer to, I think, what would be the worst situation for her, which is being trapped again inside Juniper Hill, where she's kind of stuck in there with what she now would know is an entity of the clown in Mrs. Kirsch. Right. So,
yeah.
I think that would make, if I were Lily, that would make me need way more than 2 volumes. So we didn't really talk about that, but I thought that was kind of a fun sequence where the kids get
3 volume
extremely stoned. At first I was like, these kids are going to die. Those little child bodies are not meant to take that much volume. Like, I know she mentions that her mom eats them like candy, but that was sort of like a joke about the time, like women, in a lot of situations in the of that time built a big tolerance because they were taking a lot of those because they were very heavily prescribed. They were the opioid epidemic of their day. So I for a second there, I was like, this is how one of these kids dies of just random overdose in the sewer. Or the other thing I thought would have been funny, but no way the show does, is like the kids all take the Valium and just like fall asleep outside the sewer and never end up in there. But then we don't get most of the tension of this episode.
They also have the Marge stands up to the patty cakes, which I think is fun. My question to you is, Marge stands up to the patty cakes about what? There's a possibility that the patty cakes are going to turn to, I mean, based on the rest of the trailer, going after Hank, they're going to be racist patty cakes for a little bit.
Sure.
So they're going to try to get Marge to maybe like turn on Ronnie or Ronnie and Lily or some such thing now that she's hanging out with them. There's other possibility that they keep Marge and the patty cakes specifically about Lily.
Yeah.
And they're just like, why are you covering for your friend stabbing you in the eye with a wood chisel? And Marge is like, you know, no. Something's haunting Derry.
Yeah.
We know, I mean, the patty cakes eventually see the deadlights.
Yeah, I was going to say, do we think that it has anything to do with them seeing the deadlights?
Yeah.
Like, is this part of the description a misdirect as well? Like, it's not just her standing up to them in the classic, you know, tale of high school drama, but she has to stand up to them because they get deadlit.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't know what sort of momentum we're going to have for the following episodes, but if we are building to a big black spot episode, this episode also ending with him deadlighting a whole bunch of kids in the gymnasium would be interesting. And then we deal with the black spot and immediately there's a whole bunch of floating kids and a fog rolls in. Like, we could build some momentum that doesn't let us stop to think about what's going on, which I think is possible.
And again, as we kind of talked about in the calm, all of this stuff that they're doing with Hank, if this is part of the clown's plan, is an interesting distraction to get all of the adults of Derry going in one direction while the clown goes and deadlights all the kids.
Right.
You know, like maybe that's the plan.
So this episode description mentions that Charlotte has a plan, and we're guessing it's to hide Hank at the black spot. Mm-hmm. And it mentions that Will faces his parents' disapproval for walking into a dangerous situation, which is obviously in reference to last week. My question is, are we going to spend, and maybe this is also, as you were referencing earlier in the call, having sort of Hannibal brain, but are we going to spend the first half of next week's episode dealing with what Polly's death actually meant, since we didn't have that much time to deal with it this episode. Mm-hmm. So you know, we had that moment in the season, the mid-season trailer, where Charlotte is yelling at Leroy, being like, "You locked us in the cage with a monster." So obviously emotions are going high. The Hanlons are getting wrapped up as protagonists in this sort of like back half of the season.
Mm-hmm.
So that being said, what is Leroy's action, do you think, next episode, considering he is also a father in the titular name of the father?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think obviously we have to deal with the fallout of him almost shooting his son and shooting the a vision of his wife. And and she's obvious, and whether or not how he feels about her plan to help Hank is going to be interesting too, right? Because there's been tension between the two of them about her getting involved in that in the first place. I also think that there's one hanging thread for Leroy that we're going to have to deal with very early on in next week's episode, which is the questions that General Shaw still has for Major Hanlon. Right. Where he's like, I still have a couple questions for you. And Hanlon's like, oh, I just want to go be with my family. I don't think that Shaw is just going to let that go. So I think that that will not only create tension between those two characters, but may also spill over into adding tension to the family situation. So I am, you know, I think there's going to be a lot for Major Hanlon to do next week.
And then we also have some shots of what looks like to me Dick Halloran having black and white visions, which means I think we're getting the whole nurse flashback. What are you expecting from, if anything, from sort of Dick's Shining Unleashed vision quest? I think we're definitely going to have some flashbacks to like his war buddies being killed. That seems like it's going to happen. But if he isn't like the black and white situation, is he going to be a lore source, an exposition source, sort of a counter lore source? What's the use of a freewheeling shining man?
I mean,
in Derry,
or are we going to see? Is it just going to be the horror of him, of it being sort of unleashed on him, right? Because we've spent most of the season looking at both Major Hanlon and Dick Halloran as being effective tools against the entity.
Right.
And I do think that this episode in particular that we just watched went a long way to taking both of those things off the board. Right.
Right.
Like Major Hanlon's probably very shaken by almost shooting his kid and shooting his best friend instead. And even though he doesn't feel fear, this is going to cause some anxiety. And now that Dick Halloran's Shining is out, the clown can mess with him. And I also think that, you know, similar to the way that they didn't show us a lot of this episode in the mid-season trailer, right? Like there's no Maddie stuff. There's just like a lot of stuff they're hiding. I think Grandpa's hiding it just off screen, ready to pounce. And I think that
just a little bit more Grandpa
before we get to the real life horrors that are going to happen to the characters we've been watching. We may get some psychological terror inflicted on Dick Halloran in a way that, I mean, What if it's so bad that Dick Halloran has to leave Derry? Right? Yeah. Like, because at this point, it does seem like Dick Halloran could be the one that saves everyone, but that's not how these stories go, right? So far, the only thing that can defeat the clown is kids.
Yeah. I think Dick Halloran needs to get his shit together somehow to interact with the Black Spot, because lore-wise, he sort of needs to be there.
Yeah.
I think he does something at the Black Spot, hopefully to save like Ronnie or one of the kids or something. But then, yeah, he doesn't need to do anything for the final episode because he needs to get out of there.
He's going to want to move to Colorado like real soon.
Smart. Yeah. Okay. Let's see. What else do we think is going to happen next week? I think that's it. That's also a lot.
It's a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. So we have three more episodes of Welcome to Derry left before we have to wait for season two to be renewed, a la Alien Earth. But we will be back in your ear holes and eye holes. Gross. Sorry I said it. With another podcast for Welcome to Derry episode 6 in the Name of the Father, where apparently we're going to get some big to do. Mm-hmm. And hopefully I will figure out if lore is a trap. Until then, go out there, be excellent to each other, and I would say just don't go in the sewer.